This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
We always called each other good fellas. Like you'd say to somebody, you're going to like this guy, he's all right. He's a good fella, he's one of us. You understand?
That's our first guest, Ray Liotta, in the starring role of Martin Scorsese's classic 1990 film Goodfellas. He played Henry Hill, a wise guy, a member of a New York crime family, who testified against the family after he was arrested and went into the witness protection program. Liotta already played a tough guy in his first major role in the 1986 film Something Wild. He's since played a range of characters in commercial and independent films, and even played Frank Sinatra in the HBO movie The Rat Pack. Now he's starring with Jennifer Lopez in the new NBC series Shades of Blue. They play corrupt New York cops who take bribes, plant evidence, and shake down drug dealers in their precinct. Terry spoke with Liotta last Tuesday. They began with a scene from the premiere of Shades of Blue. Liotta's character is using a little coercion to keep one of the dealers in line.
I need to remind you about our understanding, Raul.
Oh, I remember. You wanted to protect parks and schools from the drug trade. I trusted your assurance that no one else will push into that territory.
This isn't about your turf. The dope's cut hot. I need to get it all off the street. You cracked the skull of my only lead.
I don't think you're appreciating my situation. I can't look like a b-.
You don't dispense street justice in my precinct. Now, where is he?
The girlfriend never gave him up. Tough girl. Don't worry. I'll find him.
No more mayhem, Rome.
We both want what's best for the community, Lieutenant. I think you know what that's going to take.
Let me explain to you how this works. I tolerate you because you keep your business contained and you don't cause me any aggravation. We both know that if I burned you down tonight, some punk phoenix would rise from your ashes, and I'm already starting to like him better. Is that for a reminder?
That's Ray Liotta on Shades of Blue. Ray Liotta, welcome to Fresh Air. You're going to go easy
Thank
on me,
you.
Right? You're going to be nice to me, right?
I will.
So
I think I was throwing ashes on him.
They were getting in his eyes and his nose and his mouth, and he was like choking and burning and not really liking your particular form of interrogation. Are you often cast as cops and criminals because of Goodfellas and because of Something Wild before that? Like, did that get you started in a certain trajectory?
Yeah, I guess it did. The first thing I ever did was a soap opera, and I played the nicest character in the world, Joey Perini. I got it right about 6 months out of college. I got the soap. I did it for 3 years, and then I came to L.A. For 5 years, nothing happened. And the first thing I got was Something Wild. So that kind of put me on the map because that was kind of a crazed character. But then I waited about a year until I found something different because I knew about the typecasting type things that happen. And I did Field of Dreams where I was a nice guy in that. And then along came Goodfellas, and maybe that kind of started it. But Henry Hill, the part I played, he really didn't... It wasn't that violent. Everybody else was kind of crazy around him. But yes, I've definitely played my share of them.
So I'm sure you've spoken about Goodfellas many times during your career, but bear with me while I ask you a few questions about it because I know our listeners will want to hear about it. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Swell. So Goodfellas, of course, a 1990 film. You played Henry Hill, and it's based on the Nicholas Pileggi novel Wise Guy, in which Henry Hill tells his whole story, starting from when he's a kid and he aspires to be like the small-time gangsters in the neighborhood. He ends up being their assistant and ends up being, you know, really like a part of that whole ring and ends up in the witness protection program. So I know that you listen to tapes of Henry Hill. What interested you in his voice? What were you able to pick up? And I assume that, were these FBI tapes? Was this him being debriefed by the FBI?
No, these were the tapes of that Nick Pileggi gave me.
Oh, for his
when
book.
He was writing the book of it, right. So he talked to Henry for hours. And once I got the film, I went and talked to Nick to start to get, you know, start doing my homework. And he said, here, listen to these tapes. Well, I listened to the tapes of Henry, and I listened to him every day. And that was back when everything was on cassette. So I just put it in my mother's car and listened to Henry for hours. The problem was all he did was eat potato chips. And if you've ever listened to anybody eat potato chips for like hours as he's talking, it's an extremely annoying thing. But that's basically what I did. So that told me a lot about Henry. He was just going to do what he wanted to do. And the biggest thing that I learned from it was just how casual they were, how casual Henry was about what happened. It was just like he was telling a story of what his kids were doing, how they played in a park, except they were talking about, you know, people getting killed or beaten. It was very, very casual, though.
So listening through the potato chips, when you were listening to the tapes of Henry Hill, did you pick up a lot of slang that he used? Because there's, you know, expressions through the film that you assume were a part of that, you know, wise guy culture. So did you pick up, like, language kind of things that you thought were really interesting?
I'm a big believer that the script is your Bible, and the script and a good one tells you everything that you need to know. And I just committed to the script. I learned everything. I learned that I had so much time to learn it, and I was home in New Jersey because my mother was sick at the time, and Marty was just getting ready to launch Last Temptation of Christ, and so the movie was pushed, so I had more time. So I just listened to the tapes, but I didn't get anything in terms of slang. I just know what it's like being an East Coast person, being from New Jersey, but also just the script was great. What Marty and Nicholas wrote was, you know, I just committed to that, to the words that was on the page.
Martin Scorsese was very close with his mother and even did a documentary about his mother. I assume he really understood what it was like for you to have a mother who was very sick.
Yeah, I'm sure maybe personally he did, but I didn't really bring that to the set until, I mean, to be totally honest, my mom passed away in the middle of the movie, and they told me on a particular day during a particular scene that I really had to get home that night because things took a turn for the worse. And, you know, I broke down. I went into my trailer. I had to get myself together because we had to, you know, get ready and still do the movie. And I had a scene to shoot. I grew up only 45 minutes from the city. So the crew, Joe Pesci, they came to my mom's funeral. It was really, really, it wasn't special, but it was special and nice. But that's the reality of what happened.
And so I want to play a scene, which is a very famous scene, the laughing scene, in which you and a bunch of the small-time gangsters that you hang out with, including Tommy, who's played by Joe Pesci, you're at your favorite, like, restaurant, bar, hangout. You're at a table, and the Joe Pesci character, Tommy, is telling this story. Everybody's laughing at the story. You're laughing the hardest. And after the story ends, he looks at you and he says, "What's so funny?" So let's play part of that scene. And the scene starts with you just laughing a lot at the end of his story.
Oh, Pete. Oh, gee, I wish I was big just once.
You're
a big guy.
Really funny. Really funny.
What do you mean, I'm funny?
It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk? What?
It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's funny, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Yeah, Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Eh? Oh, Anthony. He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how? What?
Just, you know, you're funny.
You mean,
so?
Man, let me understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you. I make you laugh. I'm here to amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
No, just, You know how you tell a story? What?
No, I don't know. You said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the f*** am I funny? What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
Get the f*** out of here, Tommy.
I almost had him. Stuttering f***. Frankie, was he shaking? I wonder about you sometimes, Henry. You may fold under questioning.
It's Ray Liotta and Joe Pesci in a scene from Goodfellas. So that's such a crazy scene. Like, the Joe Pesci character is so crazy. Like, that's an example of it. Because you had every reason to think that he was actually threatening you, because that's how crazy he is. There's a scene where he shoots the Michael Imperioli character in the foot, just kind of for no reason, and later just kills him. So what was behind that scene? Like, what's the difference between how that scene looked in the original script and how it looked on screen?
That was totally improv during, Joe was telling us a story. We had 2 weeks of rehearsal, which is basically unheard of with making movies. But we had 2 weeks of rehearsal.
You mean because that's a lot of rehearsal or a little rehearsal?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And you don't usually rehearse that like that. It was just Lorraine, Bob, Joe, and myself and Marty. And Joe is a great storyteller, and he was telling a story that actually happened to him at a restaurant once. And he was telling that story, and Marty thought, wow, that would be a great place to put a scene like that. And, you know, Marty just, he's a genius. So during rehearsal, Joe and I just played around with it. And then we would keep working at it and shaping it. But then the whole thing was, once we improvised it and got it all down the way Marty wanted it, it was written and in stone, and the improv became part of the script.
What our listeners can't see is that in that scene, you're not only laughing loudly, but it's like visually you are laughing. Like your mouth is like way open as you laugh, like your whole face is shaped like a laugh. It's as if like you're trying to prove, like, this is funny, I'm enjoying myself, I'm all in on this joke. And there's even a collage on YouTube of your laughter through the movie. Was that a thing for you when you were making it, that you thought that this character had to just like demonstrate that he thought something was funny and that he was enjoying
life?
That's
the way I laugh.
Is that the way you laugh?
Yeah, if I think something's funny, I think it's funny, and I just let it out. I'm amused by a lot of things. I love humor. I'm constantly joking around. It blows my friends' minds that I've never been in a fight in my whole life, and I play all these kinds of characters. It might seem exaggerated, but it's not. I just, you know, some people just have some very full laughter, full of joy, and have no shame or fear of letting that out.
You're pretty well known now. And probably your most famous film is Goodfellas. But people who are young don't necessarily know much about anything except current films. And that's kind of the joke in an episode of Modern Family that you just guest starred on. And I want to play a clip from that. It's a really funny episode. And in this episode, the three kids from the family they want to treat their uncle to a special gift for his birthday, and it's kind of last minute. So the three teenage Dunphy kids decide to buy a map to the stars' homes in Hollywood and take their uncle, who loves Barbara Streisand, to Barbara Streisand's house. So they take him there. And the uncle's played by Jesse Tyler Ferguson. They take him there, and instead of seeing Barbara Streisand in front of the house, they see you in the front yard, you as Ray Liotta. And but only the uncle recognizes you. The kids have no idea who you are. So you're trying to tell the kids who you are by listing some of your biggest films.
Goodfellas. Mm. Something Wild. Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams.
Never seen it.
We're really not that old.
Look, Ray Liotta is a very fine actor, and we have taken up enough of his time. So.
Stop saying my full name like you have to keep telling them who I am.
Well.
So, wait, you live with Barbara Streisand?
You got the map. She lived here for about 2 months, 15 years ago.
Oh.
You think the bastards would update these things to reflect the current movie star owners?
Thank you. Come on, kids. We're very sorry to have bothered
you. No, I don't want you to leave empty-handed. Come on in for a selfie.
Oh, all right. Here. Okay.
When you see my movies later, you're going to realize that this is a special moment. Come on. And cheese!
Cheese!
See, that's an old actor's trick for a perfect smile.
That's really Ray Liotta guest starring on an episode of Modern Family. That's really funny. So,
but as far as what you were saying to begin with in terms of kids knowing or not knowing, I do have kids that age coming up to me, mostly young boys, from their fathers. The fathers pass along music and books or whatever that affected them when they were younger. You know, a lot of times you pass it on to your kid. So they pass on Field of Dreams to their sons who play baseball. And some of the fathers that, show their young sons, like I've had 13-year-old kids come up to me and say, oh, my gosh, you were so good in Goodfellas. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what kind of parents do they have? That's a little too young to see that one.
I wonder if it's like a rite of passage, like an initiation thing to manhood, where fathers sit down their sons and go, son, you're old enough now to see Goodfellas. It's a great film.
It could be. I don't know. All I could say is my career has been up and down, and I like it much better being up. And when it's up, part of that is people coming up to you and saying things.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first started, like, I'm an actor. I don't want that sort of thing. All I just want to do, it's all about the work. And that's just a bunch of BS. you want people to watch what you're doing. What's the point? There's a personal side to me of challenges as an actor that I like to take on myself, and I do certain things that maybe nobody else knows why I'm doing, but it all has to do with to grow as an actor. I really believe that you never stop learning and you never really ever get there. Just like in life, the older you get, you don't arrive at, oh, I'm sorry, I'm 60 now, I've arrived. It's not true. It just keeps going. You're constantly learning thing if you're the type of person who stays open and current. My dad, who God bless him, just passed away at 98. He was hip to everything because he read, because he would watch TV. He wasn't closed down about anything. And he passed that on to me, or the way to talk to people. You could have a conversation with anybody. He kind of passed that on to me. He didn't pass music on to me because I couldn't stand. The ironic thing is I once played Frank Sinatra, and I remember my parents listening to that, and I said, oh, my God, who is this guy? Turn this off. and then I end up playing him, and now I can't, now if he's on, I listen to the Frank Sinatra station the majority of the time.
Yeah, I listen to that a lot, too. And I, too, didn't like that music when my parents listened to it all the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you played Sinatra in the Rat Pack, the HBO movie. What makes people think of you when they think of Sinatra?
Who knows? Maybe I got light eyes. I'm from New Jersey, and I curse a lot. I don't know.
Bingo, right?
I don't know.
Yeah. Did you sing before?
I started out, I never ever wanted to be an actor. It came time to go to college. My dad said, go wherever you want, take whatever you want. He just really believed in getting out and being exposed to different things, and maybe it would help you decide what to do with your life. I applied. I got into the University of Miami. This was 1973. And at that time, basically all you needed was a pulse to get in there. I got into the University of Miami. I had no idea what it was that I wanted to do. So I just went. I was just going to take liberal arts. I got to the head of the line, and they said, because you don't know what it is, what you want to do, you're going to have to take math and history. I said, oh, my gosh, there's no way. I don't even want to be in college. I'm not going to take any math and history. Right next to the line that I was in was for the drama department. I said, oh, my gosh, that's it. I'll be a drama major. Well, it's the typical actor's story. I'm in line now to be a drama major because I think that's the easiest way to get by this year. And there was a really pretty girl, and she said, you auditioning for the play tonight? I said, no. And she just berated me. Oh, my gosh, how could you not want to do the play? You got to do the play. It's all about doing plays. What kind of actor doesn't want to do a play? So I went and I auditioned for the play, and it was for Cabaret. So then you had to sing and dance. I said, I don't like singing and dance. I'm a jock from New Jersey. What the So she helped me out. I had seen Pippin. My parents took me to see a Broadway show, and it was Pippin. And there was one song in there, Magic to Do, that I really liked. I got up there, and all I can remember is the refrain, we got magic to do. I'm just doing the magic to do, and I don't know how old you are, but there used to be a group called Freddy and the Dreamers.
I remember. And I'm telling you
there
now.
There was a dance called the Freddy, so yeah. I started doing the Freddy as my dance, because they're saying you're supposed to be singing, you're supposed to be dancing as you're singing. So I just did the refrain, and I did the Freddy, and I got into it. And the first year, all I did were musicals. I was in the chorus for my whole freshman year. But there was an acting teacher there named Robert Buckets Lowry, and he was great. And they called him Buckets because he used to play basketball. Me being a jock from New Jersey, like, because when you first get into drama class, and, you know, kids who, they're just different people in a lot of different ways. And it wouldn't be the people that I would normally hang out with. And I didn't care what they thought, because here I am thinking I'm just going to be here for 1 year. It doesn't matter. So for some reason, I just really committed and listened to what Bucket said. And thank God he was an acting teacher who was kind of Stanislavski, you know, the Russian director and acting teacher. And I just listened to what he said and kind of understood and just learned. And if it wasn't for Buckets, I probably would have left. But I came back the next year, and I ended up going the whole 4 years. But during those 4 years, I graduated to doing Riff and West Side Story and just different musicals. So to answer your question, yes, I had sang before.
Well, I'm just going to savor the image of you doing the Freddy while singing a song from Pippin.
I did.
The Freddy was just like the goofiest dance ever. Yeah,
it was crazy. I've said that before, and I've done that on talk shows. And you're the only person who I've ever talked to who remembers the Freddy.
Yeah, it's kind of like you say your arms are at your side, you move them up parallel to the ground,
up and down,
and then
totally
like kick your leg to the left, and kick your leg to the right. It's almost like a calisthenic exercise.
Exactly.
The silliest. It was a novelty record with a novelty dance.
Yep.
Totally silly.
Yep.
Love it. Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been terrific to talk with you.
Thanks.
Ray Liotta spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Liotta co-stars in the new NBC series Shades of Blue. The new Showtime drama series Billions is about a clash between a powerful Wall Street hedge fund manager, played by Damian Lewis, and an aggressive U.S. attorney, played by Paul Giamatti. One of the show's executive producers is the journalist Andrew Ross Sorkin, who wrote the book Too Big to Fail about the financial collapse. Billions premieres this weekend, and our critic-at-large John Powers has this review.
Money doesn't talk, sang Bob Dylan. It swears. This is almost literally true in the blizzard of books, movies, and TV shows about our financial one-percenters. If our wolves of Wall Street love anything more than obscene wealth, it's obscene language. These guys, and they are mainly guys, don't trust anyone who's shy about dropping F-bombs. Who's effing who and how is one of the governing metaphors of Billions, a new Showtime series whose opening shot features one of its lead characters trussed up and awaiting a dominatrix. Though my heart sank when I saw this, such an image is truth in advertising. This is a show about power relationships, one that's positively shameless in its desire to grab you. Billions is built around the collision of two megalomaniacal power brokers, both played by actors who specialize in characters you can't trust. That Pavarotti of prickliness, Paul Giamatti, is Chuck Rhodes, a well-born U.S. attorney with just enough conscience that he can't completely enjoy his vaulting ambition. The calculating Rhodes dreams of being governor, which will be easier if he takes the scalp of a financial high flyer. Enter Bobby Axe Axelrod, played by perma-slippery Damian Lewis, far different here than in Homeland. He's a hedge fund maestro who presents himself as a regular guy, but is actually the kind of thug who remembers and avenges slights decades later. At first, Rhodes worries about going after Axe, who's popular because of his casual dress, blue-collar origins, and canny post-9/11 donations. But when Axe courts bad publicity by deciding to buy a staggeringly expensive house, Rhodes thinks it's safe to make his move. But there are complications. For starters, Rhodes' psychologist wife, Wendy, niftily played by Maggie Siff, is a longtime life coach at Axelrod's firm. And naturally, Axe fights back. His personal fixer, played with a mortician's sang-froid by Terry Kinney, instantly starts targeting Rhodes' staff and family. Here in the opening episode, Rhodes and Axe bump into each other and immediately begin firing shots of testosterone across one another's bow.
You learn anything from my talk?
Volumes. You stand for mine?
I know your act. You sending me messages? Because I'm here.
Well, kids in my office really thought you might buy that house. And I told them, you got big, but not that big.
They're right. I'll probably pass. It's so nice, though, you know. Feels like you're part of the beach and ocean. And all that air out there. You know about it. Your daddy's got a little place out there. He must let you use a bedroom some weekends if you say please.
Walk away.
I should. But then again, what's the point of having you money if you never say you?
Billions was created by the screenwriting team of Brian Koppelman and David Levien, who wrote Ocean's 13, among others, along with New York Times financial columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin. Together, they come up with a plot that doesn't even aspire to the earnestness of an old-fashioned Hollywood morality play. The show's basically a glossy melodrama. And it offers a melodrama's pleasures. The action clips right along, with punchy dialogue, twists and machinations, gratuitous premium cable nudity, and lots of prime acting moments. Lewis showing Axe's affability melt into ruthlessness, Giamatti's blend of righteousness and bullying when Rhodes yells at a stranger for not cleaning up after his dog. They're really good. But their effing machismo lacks inner dimension and often feels a bit generic. We've heard these alpha dogs bark many times before. The female roles feel fresher. Axe's wife Lara, played by Malin Ackerman, seems like a perky nice girl. But she's a smiler with a knife. And the show's juiciest and most original character is Wendy Rhodes, who hears everyone's secret feelings. Loyal to both her husband and to Axe, to what extent we can't be sure, this gifted psychologist plays the deepest game of all. Wendy uses her role as a confessor/advisor to nudge people into doing what she wants. She admits that such manipulation turns her on. It turns us on, too. The show perks up whenever she's on screen. When I heard that Andrew Ross Sorkin was involved with Billions, I hoped he would use his inside knowledge to depict the workings of money and power with the same precision that David Simon brought to The Wire. In fact, this series doesn't really care about such authenticity. In a way, this is hardly surprising. It's hard to explain, for example, what hedge funds do without losing or boring the audience. The thing that's done it best, The Big Short, jumped through all sorts of stylistic hoops to demystify the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis and the financial instruments that helped spawn it. You'll find none of those hoops here. The show is so eager to keep us watching that it can't be bothered to show us how the world actually works. An entertaining fantasy, Billions teaches you as much about the financial world as Empire teaches you about the music business, or House of Cards does the road to the White House.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Our next guest, Elizabeth Strout, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2009 for her collection of short stories, Olive Kitteridge. The book was adapted into an HBO miniseries starring Frances McDormand as Olive, which won 8 Emmys. Set in a small coastal town in Maine, the stories focus on an older woman who perceives herself as a no-nonsense truth-teller, but constantly humiliates her husband and criticizes her son in ways that make him feel worthless. Family histories of depression and suicide haunt the stories. Robert Redford is now adapting Strout's 2013 novel The Burgess Boys into an HBO miniseries. Stroud has just published a new novel called My Name is Lucy Barton. When the novel opens, Lucy's an aspiring writer who's a wife and mother of two young children. She's in the hospital for several weeks, feeling lonely and isolated, and is shocked to wake one day and find her estranged mother sitting beside her. Lucy grew up poor and was not treated well by her parents, but her mother's presence in the hospital is profoundly comforting. Like the characters of Lucy Barton and Olive Kitteridge, Stroud grew up in a small town in Maine. She spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Elizabeth Stroud, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a short reading from My Name is Lucy Barton. And at this point, Lucy is in the hospital, feeling very lonely.
Had anyone known the extent of my loneliness, I would have been embarrassed. Whenever a nurse came to take my temperature, I tried to get her to stay for a few minutes, but the nurses were busy. They could not just hang around talking. About 3 weeks after I was admitted, I turned my eyes from the window late one afternoon and found my mother sitting in a chair at the foot of the bed. "Mom?" I said. "Hi, Lucy," she said. Her voice sounded shy but urgent. She leaned forward and squeezed my foot through the sheet. "Hi, Wizzle," she said. I had not seen my mother for years, and I kept staring at her. I could not figure out why she looked so different. "Mom, how did you get here?" I asked. "Oh, I got on an airplane." She wiggled her fingers, and I knew that there was too much emotion for us, so I waved back and lay flat. "I think you'll be all right," she added, in the same shy-sounding but urgent voice. "I haven't had any dreams." Her being there, using my pet name, which I had not heard in ages, made me feel warm and liquid-filled, as though all my tension had been a solid thing and now was not. Usually I woke at midnight and dozed fitfully, or stared wide awake through the window at the lights of the city. But that night I slept without waking, and in the morning my mother was sitting where she had been the day before. "Doesn't matter," she said when I asked. "You know I don't sleep lots."
That's Elizabeth Stroud reading from her new novel, My Name is Lucy Barton. Why did you want to set this novel in a hospital where Lucy, the main character, is removed from family and from the outside world? I mean, her mother returns, but her husband rarely visits. Her children can't come very often.
It wasn't a conscious decision, but I did find myself sketching, meaning writing little bits of scenes. And I had this Lucy in a hospital room with her mother, and I don't really even know why now, but those sketches kept going round and round my desk, and I wasn't especially interested at first, and then I realized from experience that they kept coming back to me, and so I had to pay attention. I think that having her mother in the hospital with Lucy, they're isolated there, and it's a little bit of a crucible for their relationship.
Were you thinking about your relationship with your mother while you were writing this book?
I wasn't particularly thinking about my own mother, but I am very interested in mothers and daughters, and I've written about them before, although I've always written about different mothers and different daughters. So I was, you know, I'm drawn to that, and I think it's because, you know, it's such a primal relationship. It's the way we first see the world, most of us. So I was very interested in this particular mother. She sort of arrived at the foot of that bed and was pretty accessible to me as a writer.
Would you describe your home where you grew up?
Yes, I grew up in Durham, New Hampshire. My parents were both professors at the university. My father was in the sciences. He was a parasitologist. He had his own lab that he ran. And my mother taught writing in the English department, and she also taught writing in the high school. And we also lived in Maine on a dirt road where many of my relatives lived along that same dirt road.
Were you living on a dirt road because it was beautiful there or because of a lack of money? Or, you know, was it by choice or was it just by...
It was by choice. I think that it was very, very beautiful, actually, in Maine. It still is, but now the road is paved. But it was quite, quite beautiful, and it's just where everybody settled.
You said your family, members of the family, lived up the road. I've heard you describe it as like a lot of your family who lived there was very elderly.
And
you'd go up to someone's house and they'd invariably, somebody would be saying, "I hope I die soon."
Well, and they very often talked about their past husbands and what it was that they had fed their husband for their last meal, not knowing that it was going to be the last meal. But that was a favorite conversation that I seem to remember.
how do you respond to that as a child? That's such emotionally like heavy territory.
Well, you know, I was a kid. It was just the air I breathed. I was just sort of going in and out like a squirrel, really. I mean, I don't think they paid much attention to me. But I do remember, you know, my great aunt saying, oh, I'm so glad Frank had those potatoes the way he liked them. And, you know, then they'd say, well, yes. And Homer, he had his mackerel that night as well. And, you know, whatever.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to grow up watching women in your family live past their husband and live alone after that and miss their husband a lot. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, I grew up in an apartment building and there were women who had lost their husbands, and I always felt when I was a child like, oh no, that means her life is over. Because in the 50s and early 60s, it seemed that way to me as a child.
Right. I don't remember thinking that their lives were over. They just were who they were. And I had not known their husbands, actually. At that point, they died so long ago in my small, short little life. But many years later, when I went to law school, I got a gerontology certificate as well as my law degree. And it didn't occur to me until much later that it probably had to do with the fact that I had grown up with these elderly women. And I felt probably a sense of responsibility for them that I hadn't been aware of as a young kid.
Do you think that has to do with writing the character of Olive Kittredge, who spends a good deal of time in the stories in her 70s?
I do. I do think that that has a lot to do with it, because they were, as I said, they were just the air I breathed. And I think that, you know, there was a certain grumpiness to them, a certain maneness to them.
Did you say maneness as in
Maine,
the state, or
Maine,
meanness
yes.
as in the
no, no,
attitude?
No, no. Maine, as they were from Maine, and they were there was a quality of that in them. They were sort of, you know, depressed and stuff. I don't think of Olive as depressed, but there was a great deal of that kind of stuff that I think was finally compiled into an Olive type character.
So before you became a writer, you went to law school. What did you envision your future as being like then?
Well, the truth is that I always thought of myself as a writer from the very young age. I don't have a memory of thinking of myself as anything but a writer. And this was because my mother gave me notebooks when I was very young, and she'd say, write down what you did today and write down what you saw. And so I would. And so I always thought in terms of sentences, and I always knew I'd be a writer. And so after college, you know, I waitressed and sent out stories and did that for a few years. And then I had no luck at all, not even a nibble with any of my stories. And I began to get worried. And I thought, well, you know, what if I end up 58 years old? That was the number in my head. I thought, what if I end up 58 years old and I'm a cocktail waitress and I haven't published anything? So I thought, well, you know, I'll go to law school and I will be a lawyer, but I'll write at night. And that was misguided of me, because, you know, I couldn't. But I did go to law school. I dropped out. I went back. I finished. I did get the gerontology certificate with it. And I continued to write. The whole time I was in law school, I continued to write. And the truth is, I was a very bad lawyer. I practiced for 6 months. I was a terrible lawyer. So I realized, and I can remember this moment, I realized I came home from work one day and I thought, okay, I can probably be a bad lawyer for the rest of my life, or I can go back to writing and be a cocktail waitress who's never published anything, and that will be my life. And it just seemed an honest living at that point. It took law school for me to realize I'd just go for it as a writer. So the law school was more of an aberration, I think.
Do you think it's lucky in a way that you were a bad lawyer because it gave you less of a choice about what to do?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Like if you were good, you maybe would have felt compelled to keep doing it, even
if you
didn't
like
it.
You know, we like to do things that we're good at. I mean, it makes us feel better. And I was just absolutely terrible. But I do think that the law school training took me many years to realize that the law school training, I think, was actually quite good for my writing, because it stripped away the excessive emotion. You know, I had so much emotion dripping down me all the time when I was young, and the law is not interested in that. It's very analytical. And I really didn't mind the law school itself, the classes. And then I realized years later that was probably very good for my work.
So 58 was your magic age of, like, you couldn't imagine yourself, like, if you were 58 and still a cocktail waitress writing on the side, that would be failure. Can I ask how old you are now?
I'm just turned 60.
Oh, so, okay, so mission accomplished. By 58, you won the Pulitzer.
Right, exactly. You're exactly right. But I was ready to not win it. I was ready to go for it. That's the important thing.
When you were a young mother, how did you find time to write? What was your approach to carving out the time?
Right. I had to become very disciplined in terms of, I would have maybe 2 or 3 hours every day between, I would try and teach my classes at the community college very early so that I would have a few hours before my daughter got home from school. And I was very, very strict about that with myself. So that's really what I did for years. I would wait for those few hours every day.
And did you always know what you were going to write? I mean, did you find yourself thinking in the off hours about stories? And
I was often thinking about my work, yes. But I would sit down. I remember for many years I had a rule, 3 hours or 3 pages. And I write by hand, so I really just meant 3 pages of notebooks, you know, notebook pages filled. And I was always able to do the 3 pages, and so then I would sit for the 3 hours and fiddle around. But I would write what was most urgent to me at that time, and that proved to be helpful because then I could transpose whatever was feeling most urgent to myself into a character, and then it would be truthful. There would be something truthful there, and it wouldn't be just wooden writing.
So what you were writing was sometimes a journal, it was sometimes a story, it would depend?
It was always a journal. It was always a story. It was always a story.
I see. Okay. And by doing like 3 pages a day, did you intentionally give yourself a manageable amount so you could feel like you had succeeded at the end of each day?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I always did. I succeed. I mean, with the 3 pages, you know, I'd throw them away the next day, but.
Did you have to go back to being a waitress after law school?
No, I was married and I moved to New York and I had a child, I had a baby. And so I was able to stay home with the baby, and then I began to publish enough stories that I could teach at Manhattan Community College because they accepted the JD as a graduate degree. And so for 13 years I taught at Manhattan Community College. I loved it. I absolutely loved those students. And then I would work around my daughter's schedule and my teaching schedule.
How long did it take till something you wrote was accepted?
Oh, years. I was 41 when my novel, Amy and Isabel, was accepted, and I was 43 when it was published. I did have stories, you know, that came out very slowly until then, but it was quite slow, quite a long haul, and I just kept writing and writing and writing.
How did you maintain confidence in your writing when everybody else was telling you it wasn't good enough?
You know, again, It was just compulsion. It was just pure compulsion. I would think, every so often I think, oh, wow, maybe I should give this up. And I can remember sitting on the subway and then thinking, oh, but let me try it this way. Wait a minute. Let me just try that this way. So it just would always come back up. I just kept trying. Just kept trying a different way, a different way. And eventually I began to find my voice.
So you said that your early fiction was just dripping with emotion, that you were dripping with emotion. And yet there's so many of your characters who can't express emotion. Did you grow up being like the real emotional kid in an atmosphere where like being very emotional wasn't how you expressed yourself?
I was probably an emotional kid. I can remember my father saying, And as I said, he was a lovely man. He was just a really wonderful man. But I do remember him saying, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And, you know, that's death to a writer. But I did say things, and my mother said things. And there's one incident that I always think of. When I was little, we went to church. We went to the Congregational Church in New England. It's very plain. The Congregational Church in New England. And for some reason, I was allowed to go to the Big People's Church that day. And there was a woman there that we knew, and she had a hat on. And nobody wore hats unless it was Easter, and it was not Easter. And this woman had a hat, and it had peculiar things on it. It had dried fruit and ribbons. It was just a strange hat. And so as we were driving home, and I was in the back seat, and my mother said to my father, now, why in hell would that woman wear that hat? And I'm thinking, yeah, why would she? And my father said, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And I've always thought of that moment as sort of crystallizing the dilemma for me as a writer, because I understood that my father in many ways was the more decent person, but my mother was much more interesting, you know, because she said things, she'd say things, and she would witness things. And so I've often thought that my writing life has been a desire, well, many, many desires, but there's one aspect to it of trying to go for the decency of my father with the vividness of my mother and her observations, and getting it down and getting it truthfully down.
Your character of Lucy in your new novel, My Name is Lucy Barton, is a writer, and she's an aspiring writer. And her writing teacher, who's kind of like her mentor, Sarah, tells Lucy, if you find yourself protecting anyone as you write this piece, remember this, you're not doing it right. Is that something that somebody actually told you? Is that a rule that you follow yourself?
It's not anything that anybody ever told me, but I do remember when I was writing Olive Kittredge, I remember thinking one night when I put the work away, I thought, ooh, I don't know, maybe she's going too far. And then I, you know, with stealing her daughter-in-law's bra and all that kind of stuff, and then I thought, no, you let her go. You just let Olive be Olive, let her rip. And so that's what came back to me when I was writing the Sarah Payne advice to Lucy.
Lucy gets advice from her neighbor and friend Jeremy, who tells her that you have to be ruthless to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I think you probably have to be ruthless to be good at anything. So I don't know that ruthless is the word that I would use myself. Jeremy used it. I don't know that it would be my word. But I think that one has to make decisions about going forward and what they're going to do and what they're going to sacrifice to in order to do it.
Elizabeth Strout, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's really been wonderful. Thanks so much.
Elizabeth Strout spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Strout's new novel is called My Name is Lucy Barton. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, and Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.